Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today CQ Magazine for March 2011 in digest format. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, lowercase, one word, Handy Ham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, at courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Let's start off with ham radio news. Return of the woodpecker. Hams who were active on DHF bands in the 1970s and 80s will likely remember the so-called Russian woodpecker, an over-the-horizon radar signal originating from the Ukraine that caused massive interference across the HF radio spectrum. The woodpecker has been silent since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, but the IARU, the International Amateur Radio Union Monitoring System, is now reporting QRM, that's noise, from two OTH radar signals, one originating in Russia and operating on the 40-meter, 7 megahertz ham band, and another based in Cyprus that has been obliterating the 30-meter, 10 megahertz band in Europe every afternoon. Details are in the IARU Monitoring System's December 2010 newsletter. On the topic of QRM in Europe, Newsline is reporting that one of three Italian repeaters allegedly causing interference to the ham radio downlink from the International Space Station has voluntarily gone off 2 meters. Owners of the IR2UEF D-Star repeater noted that they were operating legally, but were shutting down their 2-meter port, quoting, "in the name of cooperation and ham radio spirit," close quote. Our next radio news piece, DX0DX, the expedition on long-term hold. Organizers of the Delta X-Ray Zero, Delta X-Ray Spratly Island D-Expedition say the operation is on indefinite hold due to paperwork and bureaucracy problems. They hope to work things out and get on the air sometime this year. New rates, formula for ARRL outgoing QSL Bureau. For the first time in 4 years, the ARRL, American Radio Relay League, has raised its rates for sending members' QSL cards to hams around the world. It also refined the formula for determining how much a packet of QSLs bound for the outgoing QSL Bureau would cost. According to the ARRL letter, the new rates, which took effect January 17, are as follows. $2 for 10 or fewer cards in one envelope. $3 for 11 through 20 cards in one envelope. 75 cents per ounce for packages containing more than 20 cards. The ARRL Outgoing QSL Bureau is available only to American Radio Relay League members. NASA seeks ham's help monitoring satellite, gets it down the hall. NASA put out a request to hams on January 19th asking them to listen for the 70-centimeter beacon of the just-deployed NanoSail-D nanosatellite. The tiny satellite, whose control team is based at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, was supposed to deploy a solar sail as part of a solar propulsion experiment. The first hams to report hearing the satellite's 437.270 megahertz beacon, according to the Huntsville Times newspaper, were members of the Marshall Space Flight Center's own ham radio club. The news was posted on the club's website and immediately passed along to Principal Investigator Dean Alhorn, who had put out the request. According to the website, Al Horn nearly exploded with joy, and club members thought we were going to need to scrape Dean off the ceiling. Our next news bit brings up that ugly subject of BPL split in IEEE over BPL standard. There is discontent in the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers over the body's recommended standards for testing and measurement of power line communications equipment, also known as broadband over power lines, or BPL, for electromagnetic compatibility. According to the ARRL letter, the IEEEEMC Society Standards Development Committee withdrew as a co-sponsor of the new standard, complaining that its concerns about certain technical content had been ignored by the IEEE Standards Board. Committee member and ARRL lab manager Ed Hare called W1RFI questioned the value of an IEEE EMC standard that does not have the support of the organization's own EMC Standards Committee. In other BPL news, the ARRL filed a complaint with the FCC in late December, charging that three BPL systems in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Indiana, all operated by IBEC, are not properly notching out the amateur bands and are causing harmful interference to area hams. The ARRL letter says the league filing called on the FCC to launch an enforcement proceeding against IBEC and to shut the systems down until they are in full compliance with FCC rules. Logbook of the World, LOTW, now supports grid square-based awards. The ARRL reports that its online QSO confirmation service, Logbook of the World, will now support ARRL awards based on Maidenhead grid squares, according to the VHF Slant UHF Century Club and the Fred Fish Memorial Award. With this upgrade, LOTW now supports all ARRL awards. CQ is continuing to work with the ARRL to eventually support CQ-sponsored awards. Federal Communications Commission sets K1MAN license renewal for hearing. The FCC has formally designated the license renewal application of controversial ham Glenn Baxter, called K1MAN, for hearing before an administrative law judge. Baxter's license expired 5 years ago but has remained valid during the enforcement proceedings. The FCC has cited him for multiple instances of alleged interference to ongoing communications, transmitting communications in which he allegedly had a pecuniary interest, and other matters. The commission now has a case in federal court trying to collect fines that it assessed but which Baxter has not paid. Baxter says he is pleased to finally be getting a hearing on his license renewal after 5 years, but notes that since the matters that will be considered by the administrative law judge are essentially identical to those before the federal court, the FCC will likely have to wait until a court case is completed before proceeding with the hearing. Quoting, "This is going to be fun," he notes, adding, "This is like doubleheader. Your tax money hard at work." Close quote. And one more ham radio news piece. Ham radio steady bill reintroduced in new Congress. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat of Texas, has reintroduced the Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enhancement Act, which passed the Senate during the last Congress but was never taken up by the House of Representatives. According to the ARRL, the bill now has a new number, H.R. 81, and has been referred to the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. The bill calls on the Secretary of Homeland Security to study the uses and capabilities of amateur radio in emergencies and disasters, and to make recommendations regarding impediments to amateur radio communication, such as the effects of antenna restrictions in private land use regulations. The FCC has said repeatedly that it will not challenge these private regulations, often known as CC&Rs, without a specific mandate from Congress. It's time now for Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by the editor Rich Mawson. Rich's call is W2VU. He titles this one, Appliance Operators? Last month in this space, I set out to bust a few ham radio myths, one of which was that hams don't build anything anymore. This belief, I said, is even older than the ham radio is dying myth. And indeed, it is a belief that has been addressed in this column before. For example, it seems that many folks think that amateur radio as a scientific service has stagnated. And in support of their beliefs, they bring up the trend toward all commercial stations, commercial antennas, and other accessories. We can't dispute this trend, but we would rather interpret it a bit differently. We feel that the availability of high-quality commercial gear has simply eased the job of the amateur in the development of communications techniques, instead of eliminating it. The point is this. Amateur radio has come quite a ways from the days of the first commercial equipment, and we must realize that each new technique development has been made possible by that same equipment. To condemn it is foolish. It just isn't possible to turn back the clock to the days when a good ham built all his equipment, from key to antenna. To encourage this is to negate the progress of 50 years of amateur radio. And many a new development has come from the shack of an appliance operator. How long ago was this written? 5 years ago? 10? Well, that last line might give you a hint. To encourage this is to negate the progress of 50 years of amateur radio, the quotation went. Next year will be the centennial of the Radio Act of 1912, which formalized call signs and licensing, and hams were active for several years before that. So when was it written? Try August 1964, penned by Dick Ross, K2MGA, who is now CQ's publisher, but was editor back then. Yes, even 47 years ago, hams were griping that nobody built anything anymore and that we were becoming a hobby of appliance operators. Yes, even 47 years ago, hams were using the term appliance operators. But as Dick pointed out then, and as is just as true today, the advent of commercial gear has not put an end to hams' innovation. Rather, it has provided a platform for even greater innovation moving forward. But what about the underlying assumption, whether in 1964 or 2011, that hams aren't builders anymore? Well, last October we asked you, our readers, about your own building activities. The results are on page 40 of this issue, and frankly, they amazed even us. 94%. Yes, 94% of the readers who responded to the survey said they had built at least one piece of radio equipment. And we're not talking about building a dipole here. 58% have built a receiver, 57% a transmitter, and 41% a transceiver. Also, we're not talking about building a rig a half century ago or a half century before that. 68% of the respondents said their most recent ham radio project was completed within the past year, 30%, or is in progress right now, 38%. Only 14% said it's been 10 years or longer since they've built anything. Now, I realize that these surveys are not scientific, but they do provide a reasonable snapshot of our readers' interests and activities, even if they are off by a few percentage points. Clearly, CQ readers are also builders, and in large measures, and that's what really matters. So what about a half century of complaints that fewer and fewer hams are building anything? Could it be that the ranks of builders hit bottom and are now on the increase? It's possible. There's evidence everywhere that CW usage has been increasing since the FCC eliminated the code test requirement. Perhaps there is a resurgence of building among hams. It's also possible that the complaints were just plain wrong, both a half century ago and today. Just like the ham radio is dying myth that hams keep retelling. Here we are at our all-time licensing peak, over 696,000 at the end of 2010. Yet, the telling point, a story last weekend in the Chicago newspaper was entitled, "Ham Radio Buffs Say Fading Hobby Serves Purpose." Sometimes you just can't win. Now it's your turn. We know you're building things, and many of you are building things of your own design, 47% according to the survey. Share. Let's see some fun, practical project articles. We don't have the space to publish long and complex projects at this point, but we'd love to see what you have to offer in the way of practical projects that are fun to build and can be put together in a weekend. Kind of like 8D5X's Weekender column that ran until Phil needed to step down and K0NEB reconfigured it into our current kit building column. Take pictures, draw schematics, and write up a brief description of what it is, how it works, why someone else might want to build and use it, and clear step-by-step instructions for assembling the project. Please read our writer's guideline. It's at www.cq-amateur-radio.com/guide.html, and then send along the article to me at my email address, w2vu@cq-amateur-radio.com, or by postal mail to the CQ office. We'll pick out the best of the best and get them into future issues. Meanwhile, keep those soldering irons warm. We'd like to welcome N2GA, November 2, Golf Alpha. I'd like to welcome George Tranis, N2GA, as our new contesting editor. As we reported last month, John Doerr, K1AR, decided to step aside after nearly 22 years of writing the CQ contesting column. George is an accomplished contester, often putting in top-tier performances from the Caribbean, and is respected for his objectivity, having served as a referee in 3 World Radio Team Sport Championships, that's WRTC, competitions. You'll find a more complete introduction in this month's contesting column on page 97. Please give George your support and feedback. That covers Zero Bias, a CQ editorial. 73, Rick, W2VU. What follows next are special event stations, which are scheduled in the month of March. K5B Kilo 5 Bravo from the 22nd Annual Bataan Memorial Death March Marathon, Las Cruces, New Mexico. That's on March the 27th. W8FT. Whiskey 8 Foxtrot Tango, celebrating 90 years of existence of the Findlay Radio Club in Findlay, Ohio. That's going to be on March the 21st on various frequencies. Here's a few hamfests you might want to go to. Hamfests are like, yard sales, I guess you could put it, in plain old people talk. March the 12th, the 2011 Charlotte, North Carolina Hamfest, Cabreras Arena and Event Center, Concord, North Carolina. That's March the 12th, next week. March the 19th, Charleston, West Virginia Hamfest. That's being held at the Coonskin Armory, Charleston, West Virginia, On March the 26th, Orange County Amateur Radio Club Spring Ham Fest, Town of Wallkill Community Center, Middletown, New York. March the 26th, Columbus, Indiana Amateur Radio Club Ham Fest, Bartholomew County 4-H Fairgrounds Community Building, Columbus, Indiana. And one more, March the 26th, Ham X, that's HAM-EX, 2011, Brampton Fall Fairgrounds, Mississauga, Canada. You can contact the Mississauga Amateur Radio Club, call sign VE3MIS for more information. And before I forget to put this one in, the SWODXA, Ohio DX Association Dinner, Dayton Hamvention 2011. The annual DX Dinner will be held this year on Friday, May 20th at a new location, the Dayton Marriott, 1414 Patterson Boulevard, Dayton, Ohio. Details are available at the website www.swodda.org. They are attempting to honor seating requests of tables of 10. And so please contact and be prepared to pay for the amount requested. You can call or contact Kirk Swallow, W8QID, 3137 Compton Road, Cincinnati, Ohio, zip code 45251. And be sure to include an SASE for the return tickets. Our lead piece in the March 2011 CQ magazine is actually a CQ interview with TV executive Bill Baker, called W1BKR, Whiskey 1, Bravo Kilo Romeo. The auditor is Rich Mawson, the editor of CQ, W2VU. Okay, everybody, raise your hand if you have your own atomic clock. Keep it raised if you have two or have been to both the North and South Poles, or have operated ham radio from Antarctic cruise ships, the Queen Elizabeth II and USS Intrepid? That's what I thought. Bill, you can put your hand down now. Welcome to the latest in CQ's series of interviews with chronic ham radio underachievers. Dr. William F. Baker, President Emeritus of WNET.org, or as he's better known on 80 Meters, Bill, W1BKR. WNET.org is the parent company of both WNET-TV, New York City's Channel 13, and WLIW, Long Island Public TV Channel 21. WNET calls itself the nation's flagship public TV station, says it is the most watched public television station in America, and WLIW is number 3, and the most prolific public TV program producer. Bill and I met and talked at the station's combined studio and production facility in Midtown Manhattan. Starting first with shortwave, Bill has had a wide-ranging and fascinating career. He is a polar explorer, a broadcast executive who helped shape the modern television industry, both commercial and public, and now, after retirement, is an independent TV producer and a college professor. A relative latecomer to ham radio as a licensee, he says he nonetheless has been influenced by hams and ham radio throughout his career. Quoting, "I started out interested in shortwave as a kid," Bill explained, recalling that his parents had taken him to visit a ham in Ohio when he was a young teen. This ham, he said, had a shortwave radio. "I never forgot it because my parents bought me his radio for Christmas. It was a Hallicrafter S53A, and that was my first radio when I was about 13 or 14 years old. Something like that. I was a shortwave listener well into my adult life." Baker's interest in broadcasting began around the same time, starting out talking into the back of vacuum cleaners when I was 13 years old, pretending they were microphones. He quickly landed a job as a technician at a radio station in his hometown of Cleveland and was working there full-time, both behind and in front of the mic, by the time he was in high school. Starting a TV career, That early exposure to the technical side of broadcasting helped direct Bill's college goals, at least at the beginning, at Case Western Reserve University, where he planned to become an electrical engineer. I got through differential calculus, and that just about broke my pick, he recalled. I made it through because I had two incredibly smart friends who later went on to become PhD engineers. But anyway, I decided kind of halfway through electrical engineering that I really wasn't smart enough to be one, and so I shifted over into communications because I'd already been working in that field. So I stayed and got my B.A., but by the time I got my B.A., I was a radio producer of a talk show in Cleveland and doing stuff for NBC Radio nationally. Bill's next move was into television. But he wasn't sure it would last. He kept his TV job but went back to Case for graduate studies. I've always been interested in psychology and organizational systems, he said. So I decided to get graduate degrees in industrial psych and organizational behavior. By the time I got my PhD, I was already station manager of the ABC station in Cleveland, WEWS, and so I just put PhD after my name and kept the job. It didn't seem like I should quit. Bill was always a hands-on manager. In 1974, he organized and led a TV expedition to Antarctica. Then, when he became manager of the Westinghouse station in Baltimore, became the first manager there to climb up the station's 1,000-foot candelabra tower, recalling that you went up in a teeny little basket and that he felt very brave until I got about halfway up. Among his other accomplishments there were giving Oprah Winfrey and Maria Shriver their first TV jobs. He later organized an expedition to the North Pole, being one of the few people ever to visit both the North and South Poles. After several years in Baltimore, Bill moved up in the Westinghouse organization, eventually becoming president of all the company's TV stations and chairman of its cable programming businesses. During his tenure, he oversaw the startups of the Discovery Channel, the Disney Channel, and the Travel Channel. Then, 20 years ago, I was asked by a hero of mine, Dr. Frank Stanton, who was president of CBS, if I would come and be president of public television in New York. I thought, boy, what an honor that is. But does it make sense to take an 80% pay cut? He said with a chuckle. My wife persuaded me that that's what I really should be doing. So I thought I would do that for a couple of years and then go back to making money. But if you really get into the purposes and the goals of public media, the mission is so high and great, you really can't leave it. So I didn't, and that lasted 20 years, and now I'm a professor. Of course, Bill did manage to accomplish a few things during his two decades at WNET, such as raising more than $1 billion to support public broadcasting, building the largest endowment in the history of public television, overseeing the merger of channels 13 and 21, the transition to digital broadcasting, the move to a new state-of-the-art studio and production facility, and the introduction of 6 new digital channels, as well as VME, the first public television station in the United States aimed at Latino viewers. He has also been executive producer and or on-the-air host of various public TV programs, including 13's Most Watched Program Ever, which he hosted, the July 4, 1992 broadcast of the Tall Ships Parade in New York City. Bill has been honored with various broadcasting awards and is a member of Broadcasting's and Cable's Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 2004, the New York State Broadcasters Association Hall of Fame in 2005, and the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Management Hall of Fame 2007, and even the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame in 2009. What, I asked Bill, did he consider the highlight of his many-faceted career? His answer might surprise you. Perhaps the highlight of my career was in many ways at the most frightening and scary time. But it showed the real value of electronic media, and it showed the greater value of the industry rather than any kind of personal achievement. And that was September 11th, he said, referring to the terrorists' attacks on New York City. When it all happened, what I said to my people was, don't worry about money. Don't worry about anything. Just think of only one thing, serving the people of our community, whatever it takes to really do that, and let's be creative about how we can do this. The commercial media did a brilliant job, Bill continued. Public television decided we couldn't do the same thing because we didn't have the capacity they had with mobile units and everything. So we decided to put all this in context. We did programs. We had religious leaders from all over the faiths sitting in the studio with Bill Moyers, and I was one of the people. So for me personally, it was quite an experience interviewing during that time on worldwide television. There was more that went on behind the scenes. One of the people in our station said, you know, we've got the biggest phone system in New York because of the telephone pledge drive. And they said, why don't we make that available to the Red Cross? So the whole Red Cross and a part of the Office of Emergency Management all moved into our facility. We set up tables and everything for them there. It was really quite a moment in my career, and I think the career of electronic media, in the life of electronic media in America. All of this, of course, occurred over a background of personal loss. Many people at Channel 13 had relatives or friends who were killed or injured in the attacks, along with one colleague, transmitter engineer Rod Coppola, K-A-2-K-E-T, who was at work that fateful morning at the station's transmitter in one of the World Trade Center towers. He is now memorialized by a plaque in the Channel 13 lobby. I mentioned to Bill that most of our previous interview subjects believe that our country is facing a crisis today in terms of getting young people involved in science and technology. And most of them also believe that activities such as ham radio can play a role in helping to face that crisis. I asked Bill, as a technology executive and college professor, for his take on this situation. I absolutely agree that that's a major, major issue in this country, and it's a frightening one, he replied. It's a frightening one for this country. Ham radio can play a role and should play a role, and I don't know why the education community, the science centers of America, and other places haven't been more embracing of ham radio. It just puzzles the heck out of me. I don't think education departments at schools, other places, have taken full advantage of that. I'm now housed at Fordham in the Graduate School of Education, and one of my goals, not yet even started, is to figure out how to bring ham radio into the education of some of these future science teachers who are going to ultimately get the word out. But it's a major issue. It's one in which we're clearly behind. I've been fortunate enough to get a bunch of honorary doctorate degrees, and you sit up there on the podium and these big schools are issuing doctorates. Almost all of the PhDs in scientific fields are going to non-Americans, usually Asians. What does that say? He paused, then concluded with a smile. Unless they're working for Kenwood or ICOM, I'm troubled by that. When all is said and done, the bottom line for Bill is that ham radio has always been and continues to be a place to turn for a new perspective or just a break. Ham radio has seemed to follow me, he noted. I mean, it's such a thing of pleasure and joy. I have a lot of worries in my life. I've always been, for the last 50 years, under a huge amount of pressure in these media jobs. But a source of a great kind of relaxation and inspiration has been ham radio and my ham radio buddies. That concludes the CQ interview with TV executive Bill Baker, called W1BKR, by Rich Mawson, editor of CQ Magazine. Rich's call again, W2BKR. KVU. Well, for a change of pace, I have the results of the 2010 CQ WWWPX CW contest. They're submitted by Randy Thompson, K5ZD. I'm not going to explain all those acronyms. Those of you who are involved and are most interested in the results will want to take a look at the CQ for March 2011, beginning on page 20 and going all the way through to page 32. It's a tremendous amount of detail, and all of the information you CQRY WPXEW contesters are looking for. I hope one of you listening is one of those that sees your name in print. We're going to change the subject now to the fact that many of you who listen to me are in rather restricted space. And antenna restrictions cause a lot of problems for people who can't really get a good signal out of their location. An article here titled PSK31 in the Attic. The author is Stan Zarautny, K4SBZ. Antenna restrictions almost pushed K4SBZ out of ham radio for the second time until he discovered PSK31. Like many amateur radios today, I am plagued by the dreaded CCNRs, covenants, conditions, and restrictions. These restrictive covenants prevent thousands of us from enjoying our hobby to its fullest extent by not allowing us to have antennas visible outside our homes. Originally licensed in 1959, I had to drop out of the hobby for occupational reasons in 1964. I was relicensed in 2007 as an extra class, but was confined to chatting on the local VHF repeaters when I found that I was barely able to get out of my backyard on high-frequency HF. I was almost ready to drop the hobby again out of frustration. Now, PSK31 to the rescue! Then, in early 2009, I read an article about PSK31. The thing that struck me most about it was that because of its narrow bandwidth, this relatively new digital mode was able to get through better than many other modes such as single sideband. The second thing that I noted about PSK31 is that one of its most popular operating bands is 20 meters. Some quick calculations told me that a 20-meter dipole was only about 33 feet long and would easily fit into my attic, out of sight of a CCNR police. After a bit more research, I was able to convince my XYL that the investment was not going to be very substantial. Unlike older digital modes that require an expensive TNC, I only needed to add a fairly inexpensive sound guard interface, a rig blaster, signal link, or whatever, to my already existing gear, along with the 20-meter dipole. A substantial savings is that one of the most popular PSK31 software interfaces, DigiPan 2.0, is downloadable for free. Some of the other popular Windows PSK31 software include WinPSK, MixW, DM780, HamScope, MultiPSK, WinWarbler, and Zakanaka. I prefer DigiPan because it can simultaneously display multiple channels of conversation in addition to the traditional waterfall display of the spectrum. Using the multi-channel coloring effect option in the color configuration, I color all channels containing CQ blue so that I can spot them immediately. I also color any channel containing my own call sign red so that I don't miss any calls. With DigiPan, all you have to do is click on the line with the text to tune to that frequency. How much easier can it get? I position DigiPan in the top half of the computer window as shown in the figure here. With DigiPan, you can click on a call sign in the received text window and it will fill in the call field. There is a macro available that provides an automatic lookup of the call sign in the call field using QRZ.com. In the lower left corner, I load QRZ.com, reduced, so that I can quickly identify any stations calling CQ or that respond to my CQ. In a fourth quadrant of the computer screen, I place my logging software, XMLOG. Plans for a dipole can be found in just about any antenna book. However, it's basically two pieces of wire strung in opposite directions from a center insulator. Because the PSK31 band on 20 meters starts at 14.070 megahertz, the specific measurements for the dipole is 32.9 feet total, or 16.75 feet for each leg. I used insulated copper wire, 14 or 16 gauge is fine, for the antenna. This enabled me to route the antenna through the attic without too much concern about touching the rafters, although I also used standard standoff insulators where possible. My routing was not totally direct. I used whatever worked for me, but it is relatively straight. I used a one-to-one balun for the center insulator with a run of coax to my rig. I have to admit that the insulation was not elegant. Elegant or not, though, my first contact was in Germany from Florida, running my ICOM 706 MKIIG at less than half power, as you are expected to do with PSK31. Since then, I have worked EX from Moscow to Hawaii, and all ideas of giving up my ticket have long passed. As a matter of fact, my XYL just got her general so that she can join in the fun. Thanks a lot to Stan Zatoratny, K4SBZ, for his PSK31 in the attic story. Well, we have a big birthday announcement for a ham radio legend. Leo Meyerson, W0GFQ, celebrates his 100th birthday. Leo Meyerson, W9GFQ, and later W0GFQ, owned and operated World Radio Laboratories from his factory in Council Bluffs, Iowa. His more famous products included the Globe Scout, Globe Champion, and Globe King lines. For many beginning hams, the Globe Scout was their first transmitter. He was and still is respected and beloved by his worldwide customers and competitors alike. Leo is celebrating his 100th birthday, and a big party at his winter home in Rancho Mirage, California, was scheduled for February 24, 2011. The celebration was to include a special event station, W0G, Whiskey Zero Golf, on 14.260 megahertz plus or minus between 1800 Zulu and 2400 Zulu. Leo may not be able to talk to everyone who QSOs, but he will be nearby, said Gene Pentecost, W4IMT, president of the Quarter Century Wireless Association, that's the QCWA, Chapter 154, which is sponsoring the special event station. For the many who have fond memories of Leo and his radios, here's a chance to give him a shout. QSLs should be sent to the operator you contact, so be sure to make a note of who's behind the mic. Happy birthday, Leo, from all of us at CQ. Well, folks, as I just read that, I realized that that time frame has already passed. It said here February 24th, 2011, which was about 2 weeks ago. But if you did, by any chance, have a contact with the station, the special event call being W0G, Whiskey Zero Golf, do indeed send your QSL card request to the operator with whom you made the two-way. Happy birthday, Leo. Let's take a look now at the learning curve. The author is Rich Arland, K7SZ. It's titled, Hey Sailor, How Much Does Your Anchor Weigh? Ah, a nautical theme, huh? Hardly. Welcome to the world of boat anchors, BAs. More accurately described as really heavy tube-type radio gear. That's right. This series of columns will cover the mystical world and allure of antique communications gear. I actually have been having second thoughts about writing this column. After all, who wants to receive death threats from a radio aficionado's mate? Seriously, what we are about to embark upon is a boat anchor restoration project. Actually, several BA restorations. And while it is fun, let me forewarn you that collecting, restoring, and using boat anchors can be extremely addictive, ultimately culminating in a garage or basement or attic full of old rusty radios awaiting restoration. Not around this house, guys, but it happens. Don't say I didn't warn you. Over the last 15 to 20 years, there has been an upsurge in collecting, restoring, and using antique radio gear from the bygone era of early radio communications. What cost hundreds of dollars in 1963 can be found for mere pennies on the dollar today. As hams upgrade their equipment, the older vacuum tube or early transistor pieces of radio gear many times find their way to hamfest flea markets or to internet auction houses. Today, it is possible to gather the gear to replicate a 1950s to 1960s novice station for well under $200. Many of us old farts, P-H-A-R-T-S, who have been in the hobby for a long time, have a love affair with equipment from our early days in ham radio, SWLing. When I was first starting in the radio hobby until I was well into my 40s, discretionary income was not available at the Arland household to allow me to procure some of the treasures of my radio past, the gear that I lusted for but could never afford. In 1963, the year I became a novice class ham, we ham radio newbies were relegated to very narrow slices of 80, 40, and 50 meters and 2 meters. Our gear could not generate more than 75 watts of input power and had to be crystal controlled, plus CW only on HF and CW AM phone on 2 meters. Commercial equipment manufacturers such as E.F. Johnson, Heathkit, World Radio Labs, ICO, etc., offered several transmitters that fit the bill and, of course, receivers galore. Being a frugal, you can read that broke, young lad of 16, I started out with a borrowed BC-453 ARC-5 command set, receiver loaned to me by Mel Sims, W7CIS, one of the local Elmers in my hometown of Palos, Washington. The BC-453 was a military aircraft receiver that was powered by a dynamotor to get high voltage for the vacuum tubes from a DC input. The dynamotor was basically a motor generator device that took a 12 or 24 volt DC input and provided several hundred volts of DC on the output to power the vacuum tubes inside the ARC-5 receiver. Hope we haven't lost you, folks. There is a certain tantalizing ambience regarding the sound of dynamometer spinning and CW spilling from the speaker of a BC-453. Mom didn't think radio should have motors. Little did she know. This 80-meter ARC-5 receiver gave way to a Heathkit HR-10 ham band's only receiver, which I built during Christmas break in 1963. The HR-10 was my first real communications receiver, and I was really proud of it. After all, I'd built it myself. I don't know what happened to my original HR-10. I went off to college after high school and then on to the U.S. Air Force for 20 years, so the original rig got lost somewhere. However, I had the good fortune to find one in very good shape on a table at a ham radio flea market about 15 years ago. The price, $30, was right. So the old gal came home with me to a place of honor inside my shack. Before we get into the actual restoration of this rig, let's go over some of the basic fundamentals of receivers. After all, that is what this column is all about, learning about the radio hobby. First, a little history. A 24-year-old Columbus University undergrad by the name of Ed was the first person to take the Lee DeForest Audion tube and make it do something useful. Although DeForest invented the triode tube in 1906. He had really no idea what to use it for. Enter Ed. one of the founding fathers of modern radio. The young college student had his lab set up in his bedroom, and one evening while experimenting with the Audion triode, he managed to stumble upon a feedback circuit that took power from the output of the tube and fed it back in phase into the input of the tube, which made the tube oscillate. This increased the gain of the tube by several thousand times and became the basis for the regenerative receiver. Here you have a kid working in his bedroom making a discovery that ranks right up there with that of the wheel. As he grew older, Ed continued to experiment and gave us the following. The regenerative receiver, 1914. The super regenerative receiver, 1922. Mixers, super heterodyne receivers, 1918. And the real biggie, frequency modulation, 1933. Ed's first name was Edwin Howard Armstrong, 1890 to 1954, Major U.S. Army. Ed worked with David Sarnoff, president of RCA, over the intervening years and produced many valuable patents for that company while simultaneously advancing the state of electronic communications. We owe a lot to Ed. Even today, virtually every receiver in use, from the lowly AM/FM unit in your automobile to satellite and microwave receivers, is most certainly a super heterodyne. You can call it super het receiver. Talk about a lasting legacy. But getting back to the HR-10 saga, my newly acquired HR-10 was in good cosmetic shape. All the knobs were original, the switches all worked. The radio had a coveted option 100 kilocycle crystal calibrator. The dial cord was still properly strung, and the dial pointer moved freely. All the tubes checked good except one, and I had a replacement on hand from a previous vacuum tube project. A good overall cleanup was followed by disassembling the entire receiver, pulling all the tubes, removing the knobs, etc. Once fully clean, I use a wash of Simple Green and water, which works in about 90% of the cases. It was time to start putting things back together. However, before reassembly, I wanted to do a visual inspection of the underside of the chassis, paying particular attention to bad, poor solder connections, any discolored components, especially resistors, and any bulging electrolytic capacitors, burnt wires, whatever. Often a simple visual inspection using a magnifying glass and a high-intensity lamp can reveal problems that wouldn't be apparent until you powered up the rig. Now is the time to find these anomalies, not after you see sparks flying when you flip the switch to the on position. I guess that's happened a few times. This vintage receiver used carbon composition resistors, which are notorious for going out of tolerance over time, and it's been a long time. While carbon comps were the industry standard 50 years ago, they have been virtually eliminated by the carbon film resistors we use today. This HR-10 was no different, and I ended up replacing several suspect resistors. To further elaborate on this point, a few years ago, I had a Hallicrafters SX-71 shortwave ham bands receiver on my bench. The SX-71 was a favorite of mine from the shortwave radio heydays of the 1950s, and this one had seen some hard use over the years. While the SX-71 was working, it was not working well. In checking the old carbon composition resistors with a digital multimeter, I noticed that fully 95% of them were way out of tolerance. This necessitated removing each offending resistor and installing a new carbon film resistor in its place. As you can imagine, this took quite a while. But when I fired up the receiver and put it on the HP test generator, the alignment was almost perfect without touching a single adjustment. That is what a little work can do. Well, folks, the author goes on in some further detail about other correction and necessary procedures that come with this kind of playing with old equipment, but we'll wrap it up at this point. Next month, the author will take an in-depth look at the Heathkit HR10 ham bands receiver, CIRSA 1963, and provide some tips on restoring it or any other vintage boat anchor receivers. That was 73 from Rich, K7SZ. Well, I think I'll finish up with Kids Corner, the author Brittany Decker, KB1OGL. She titles this one, Introducing the WK1RK Kids Club. To kick off the first Kids Corner column of 2011, I thought I'd take a look at a different kind of amateur radio club. In the past, I've looked into various clubs, scouting clubs, kids clubs that reach internationally, and clubs that are prospering and growing in membership. However, I thought it would be interesting to look at how a club, especially a kids club, grows into being many members strong and well-known, such as the Yacht Club. The WK1RK Kids Club is only 3 months old. For a club in its earliest stages, I was really taken by surprise at the great ideas that they have. Philip Nichols, N88YE, an experienced and devoted amateur radio operator, is the founder of a WK1RK Club. Philip, being introduced to radio by a friend of his when he was young but not taking interest, didn't get his start in radio until he had his first child. He had always been interested in radio and computers, too, but didn't get the drive to get his license until that time. He set out to get his Tech Plus, which led to his General, to his Advanced, and with the inspiration of his son, he got his Extra as well. Not only is Philip licensed, but his four kids are too. It is immediately apparent how he got them all interested. Ham radio has been present for his enjoyment right when he needed it. Quoting, "Well, in the winter of 1996, when my second son was born, we needed extra income," Philip explained. "I had already spent years working at the dealership as a mechanic and driver, and later on a CDL, that's a commercial driver's license, allowed me to drive a school bus. I like driving for relaxation and entertainment. I got a temporary job driving for a transport company until my main job resumed. I had a Yaesu FT-11 and a Mac-mount antenna. These went with me from Detroit to Lansing to Ypsilanti. 5 days a week, I set up a string of repeaters and passed away the hours making friends. It made those hours of constant driving in winter wonderland enjoyable. My favorite was once in the summer of 1996 when two friends from church invited me to the Michigan International Speedway for some major event. My oldest son, Joshua, now KDAGOF, was with me. He was 5 years old and thought cars were just cool. I had no cell phone in those days, most of us did not, and so my HT, handy talkie plus phone patch, was my casual and emergency communication. I enjoyed my radio for scanning as well as communication. I always have a string of public safety frequencies in the memory and added racing as well on this day. I have not been a scout in a long time, but be prepared is just in my nature. I programmed repeaters along the way and brought the repeater directory in the shoulder bag with all those goodies required by a 5-year-old on a day trip. Good thing, because my friends got lost. Not that they would admit it. They knew where they were, but not where the speedway was. APRS would have been handy. I reached out with the mag mount and called the local repeater. Someone answered my call and gave great directions to the speedway, and we had a good time of it there. Not only has Philip formed his own ham family, but his four kids, Joshua, KDAGOF, 18 years of age, Joseph, KD8NYC, 14, Michael, KD8OEV, 12, and Kathleen, KD8OTM, 10, have helped to form the WK1RK Kids Club. They have been talking to their local club and on local repeaters with parents who begin to wish that their own children enjoyed radio as much as Philip's children did. They decided that a kids' net would really help to generate interest in local kids, and a kids' club would do even better. With the right kind of support, they could start getting all kinds of young people interested in radio. In order for the WK1RK Kids Club to grow, it needs a lot of support. The question of how to get more kids involved in amateur radio always comes up, and now, right in front of us, is the opportunity to do something to help. With donations or even support by referring kids to the club or checking into the net yourself or with your own kids, the WK1RK Kids Club could make a lifelong impression of amateur radio on a young ham. Young amateurs who get a good experience as kids are more likely to carry it into their adult lives as a cherished hobby and hopefully pass it on to their own children. As Philip puts it, kids are the future of ham radio. To support the WK1RK Kids Club, contact Philip Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, by email at lowercase WK1RK at cmrk.net. Or you can send it by postal service to the call sign WK1RK, care of Philip Nichols, 15240 Marlow Street, Marlow Street, Oak Park, Michigan, MI, 48237. And for more information about the Nets, you can visit the club website if you have internet capabilities at www.cmrk.net/WK1RK. The article is signed 73 Brittany KB1OGL. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings me just about up to time for this month's reading and digest format of the CQ magazine for March 2011. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. There's a wealth of information on the website. It's kept up to date every single day of the year. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF. November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, if you will, Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're about 50 miles south of Boston, right near Buzzards Bay and good old Cape Cod. Have a great springtime. It's been a long, hard winter everywhere in this country, so let's watch for the flowers to bloom and enjoy it. 73.